Turuntuset tulee jo on äl.
Today we are going to talk about marketing a museum. You, Mark, have a long career and experience in marketing different museums in Estonia. It seems that the topic is becoming hotter and hotter. It's more interesting for marketeers to market a museum than to market a telecom company that or a bank. It's also important that one of the biggest museums in Estonia, Estonian National Museum, is going to open its doors in the new building in September. And that's why many smaller museums are afraid of losing a major amount of their regular customers. So it's right time to talk about the museum marketing here in Estonia. Can you tell me what have been the latest trends in museum marketing? What happens in that field internationally?
Well, I think it's quite a well-trodden course, and there's a lot that one can learn from the biggest museums, because a lot of what they do, I think, is equally relevant to smaller museums or in museums that have less money to market. I think the trend is definitely moving towards digital methods of reaching audiences. The trend is also very much moving towards a sense of membership of museums. So there's been a big growth in audience participation in membership and a big growth in digital activity, which on the one hand is a means of generating revenue through membership, and on the other hand, through the digital side, is a means of engaging audiences really deeply in the artworks that and the collections that reside in museums. So there's definitely a transition going on. It's definitely modernizing, and it's definitely becoming a lot more interesting for both the institution, but also the audiences that are engaging with them.
What are the best example of the digitalizations?
I knew you'd ask me that. I think it starts with, actually, I think it starts with a very basic thing, which is about digitizing the collection and making the collection available online to audiences. There was for years a debate about if you put art on the internet, then people won't come and see the real thing. What actually has happened is the complete reverse. The more you put online, the more people want to see the real thing. Because online is never the real thing. It doesn't pretend to be the real thing. And actually, people just therefore want to see the real thing, which is not what people thought. As is the case in every digital disruption, what people think is invariably not what happens. Something completely different happens. And in the case of art online, it's been part of the boom. It's been associated, certainly, with the boom in visits to galleries and visits to see artwork. So the first thing I would do is ensure that the artwork is digitized and is available to the audience, and to not get in this slightly stupid discussion about should this work go on, should that work go on. Assuming there are no copyright issues, all work should go online and be available to everyone. So that's the first thing I would do. I would then go very big on social media. If you look at the big museums, they are really active in social media. It costs very little, but it does take time, and it requires not just a person, but the institution to do it as a whole. But if you look at the biggest museums and some small ones, they have really big footprints, lots of followers in the digital social media space, and some of the stuff they're putting out there is terrific, absolutely terrific.
Absolutely.
So use Instagram, use Facebook, use as many as you can, and the full knowledge, all you got to do is follow the audience. That's the only thing you have to do. And following the audience basically means, you know, I don't know if Facebook would even exist in 10 years' time. So be on Facebook now and be on the next new thing that comes up when it comes up.
Yeah, this is where we tell that that with the younger generation, we just learned the word WhatsApp, and then they are already in the Snapchat. So
yeah,
when we learned the Snapchat, then we are waiting where they are now.
Yeah, don't even believe it's just the young generation. Okay, people always say, yes, it's not just the kids at all. You know, my parents are 82 and 78. And they're just getting on social media, and they're using it, and they are digital Luddites. But it's not just young people, it is everyone. And people often mistake it as being just young people. Everyone's doing this stuff.
Absolutely. How are the customers changing? One of the things is the digitalization, the channels, how we reach them. But their needs and interests, do you see any changes there?
They remain fundamentally the same. What is very interesting is it's allowing you to have a different type of discourse. One of the things in galleries and museums is it can be terribly intimidating because you often feel you need to know a lot about art before you go to a museum or feel comfortable in a museum. I don't think that's true. But to get to that point, you have to visit museums quite a lot. And museums are often very cold, austere places that I think could present themselves better. And curiously, in the digital space and the social media space, they take liberties and they're more informal with the way they present themselves, which I think makes it a lot easier for people who aren't 100% confident about art or how to respond to it to engage with it and realize that actually it's just art and you should enjoy it. And if you want to go on a journey, then you can really find out deeply about it. But often museums in the physical space assume that you have to have a lot of knowledge. Museums in the digital space don't. And so the relationship is more informal, which I think is fantastic for new audiences and indeed existing audiences.
How should a museum choose customers or customer segments? Is it important to try to target everyone who is living nearby if you have smaller museums? Or should it be still wise to try to focus in some segments?
Yeah. I think unless you are, you know, a big national museum, depends what your remit is. I mean, the remit of the Tate was to enhance and increase people's knowledge about art. And something like Tate is a truly national institution that is free to entry and is part of the public domain. And it is actually for everybody, but not all museums are for everybody. And I think it's silly to believe that they are. So I think there is a level of segmentation. It can be by art type or by subject matter that I think an audience, well, I would hope that the direct audiences would naturally understand. One of the problems with museums is that they don't like this whole segmentation business because
That's true.
Yeah, they think it's sort of dirty and smells a bit of marketing and is a bit of a dark art and we're bigger than that. Well, you are actually, but the skills of marketing can help people ensure that more people come and more of the people who you want to come will come to your gallery. So I think it's you know, what can start as quite unhappy bedfellows can end up being very, very close relationships between marketing people, curatorial staff, and museum directors. Because actually, at the end of the day, they both want exactly the same thing. You want more people to come to your museum and appreciate the art that's on the wall. But that doesn't mean it's for everybody. Interestingly, if you take, for some of your listeners, for those of them who've been to London, my guess is the first place they go to by art gallery would be Tate Modern because it's the contemporary art museum. And people, for some reason, seem to prefer contemporary art. There's another Tate in London called Tate Britain. And Tate Britain is basically British art from 1500 to the present day. Actually, I think it's a much better museum because it's got some extraordinary artworks, but a lot of them are in gilt old frames. And some people don't like, they think gilt old frames means boring artworks. It's far from the truth. That's clearly not true. But they think that, and they think contemporary art is just easier and it's more fun. But the sorts of people who go to the Tate Britain, which is a bit more, it's more, you know, historic museum as well as present day, tends to be an older audience and an audience that understands art a bit better. Whereas Tate Modern has become another tourist attraction if you go to London. So they do attract different audiences. Recently, I was working in London. There's a very sweet museum. It's a house, actually, in London, where Handel, the musician, the classical musician, lived in the, I can't remember, 17th or 18th century. 200 years later, Jimi Hendrix lived in the same building. So you've got Handel, i.e. Handel's Messiah, and Jimi Hendrix, the world's greatest rock star, happened to live in the same building with a gap of 200 years.
Wow.
And for years in London, it was called the Handel Museum because they didn't know what to do with the fact that Jimi Hendrix actually spent 2 years living in the same building. And now they've renamed it the Handel Hendrix Museum. No, sorry, it's the Handel Hendrix House, and it's a museum to both of them. And the first three floors are all about Handel, and the top floor in the attic, where Jimi Hendrix lived, has now been recreated, and the room has been recreated how he lived in it. And it is two completely different audiences. The people who go and see Handel, as you can imagine, are all over the age of 60, love classical music. The people who go to see Hendrix, well, some are over 60, but they're all basically rock guitar enthusiasts. And sometimes the two don't meet. And what's lovely is when you see the Hendrix people in the Handel Museum and the Handel people who go upstairs to see the Hendrix. It's hilarious. And I think it's a lovely sort of, and both find each other, and you wouldn't necessarily go to them if you were fans of one or the other. But they do, and it's proven a big success.
Are there any other secrets? Or what are the secrets? How can you attract? Is just changing the name and changing the exposition, is this enough?
No, it's not. Ultimately, as in every case, it does come down to the quality of work that is there. And in my view, some of the greatest museums are those that have clearly extraordinary artworks. The incredible thing about art is it's frequently a one-off. So you get one chance to see the real thing. If you happen to own that real thing, then that is a great reason to go. If your museum can naturally tell the history of a period of artwork, that's a great reason to go. If your museum is telling the history of a nation state, that's a great reason to go. There are multiple reasons which can be from a single object to the narrative that you're telling. Now, Tate Britain in London tells the narrative history of British art from 1450 to the present day. That is a great story. Tate Modern tells the history of contemporary modern art basically from the 20th century to the present day. So I don't think museum is an everything for everyone. I think it needs to be. You have a very clear sense. Why are you here? What are you trying to show? And to who are you trying to do that? And I think you need to answer those three questions really clearly before doing it. There's nothing worse than going to a museum and realizing that it's just a bunch of stuff on the walls without a clear reason for being there. It's not enough anymore. You need to have a clear narrative of why you're there.
I do absolutely agree with you.
Yeah.
You told about different customer segments that can be attracted with different topics or different different kind of, let's say, layers or parts in the expositions. Are there any other ways to attract different customers? Is there a chance, let's say, that if I say that the major customers are the, I don't know, the schools and teachers and schools group trying to learn the local history, let's say, how the people lived in the area before. Yeah. How can I attract international, I don't know, tourists to these museums? Yeah. Can I tell them the same story? Or should I change the story even when the museum is the same?
No, I don't think you can. I don't think it depends how far you can stretch the realms of credibility. I think, this is really obvious, but you need to be true and honest all the time. And if you're doing the history of Estonian museum, you can do that for children and do it for adults in the same museum. But the narrative is essentially the same, but you're changing the layering through which people view it. So a child is going to view it slightly differently to an adult, and you need to provide content that is relevant to both, or is layered differently. But I think it needs to be built on a fundamental truth, or else you're just going to confuse everybody.
Is there any secrets about how to reach the different customer segments?
This is where it gets interesting, because in a marketing sense, marketing should always start from the customer perspective. And I think there are no secrets. I think it's a whole series of small things that you have to do. It can be anything from, one of the best ways we did it at Tate was we had many commercial partnerships with companies that helped us raise funds to bring in audiences. We would also have academic partnerships. So we would hit the academic community. From a general public point of view, I think reaching different segments, decide who are your five priority segments or three priority segments, and decide exactly what you're going to say to them. So, for example, at Tate, they had a very big schools program, which you just referred to. The schools program, you could book two schools a day, could come in, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. So that was placed on an online booking form, and schools would come in and they would book and they would take their turn. That's one way of doing it. The more general, we would also have sessions for urban and ethnic minorities. So one of the issues we did was one Friday every month, we would have what we called Late at Tate. And Late at Tate is targeted at 16 to 25-year-old people living in the urban area around the museum. And both museums in London they're very much in central London. And frequently people who live next to the museum might never go to it because they think it's not for them. So we created these evenings in the museum, which were essentially nights of, they weren't club nights, but they were almost club nights, where we would have DJs, musicians would come in, and it would be like a really cool atmosphere in an otherwise museum that you wouldn't expect that. And for Tate, targeting the 16 to 25-year-old urban young people was one of the groups that was hardest to get because they believed it wasn't for them. Putting on what we called Late at Tate meant we were curating an evening that was relevant for them, and it was packed out, absolutely packed out.
Wow. It's a good example to follow, yeah. I think, here in Estonia as well.
I would. I mean, we would do late night evenings. You know, some people can't come in the daytime or they can't come on the weekend. So why don't you open till 10 on Thursday and Friday night? Or one or other of the night, and you get a different audience come in. You get a younger crowd. You get the crowd who will come in before going out for dinner, because there is a group who will come anyway. You know, your average museum goer is just going to come. That's not who you need to worry about. What you need to worry about is the other audiences surrounding that, who are either younger or older, or who don't think the museum is for them. Don't spend your money or your marketing time on the audience that you know is going to come.
To build up this type of events, is it worthwhile to do it just once, to do all marketing for that? Or should it be kind of series of events, let's say that we are late open every Wednesday until the end of the year?
No, I think you have to do a series. Otherwise, the one-off people, it's amazing how many times you need to tell people what's going on before they remember. So my feeling is you have to do a whole series. And we used to do Late at Tate's the first Friday of every month. So there were 12 in a year. And if you forgot one, there was always a chance to go to another one another time. And the opening, the late night was exactly the same. But we had it, people will forget. You need to give people more chances to go. So I think doing a sequence is very important.
How long time did it take for you to reach the optimum amount of visitors during, for instance, Late at Tate? So probably the first event was the lowest amount of visitors, or was it vice versa?
It wasn't actually. It was very high because we marketed it very carefully and got some big name DJs in there. Now, the truth is the people are coming for the DJs, for the experience, and the art appears secondary. But when they're in the, you have to be honest. You are curating this evening of entertainment, bit of alcohol, a bit of music, a bit of fun, bit of theatre, a bit of poetry readings. You're doing it where art is sympathetic to that, but it's not necessarily all about the art. It's about getting people into a room where art is that they will then appreciate.
Are these same people coming back only for this type of events?
No,
do they associate?
Yeah,
or
good question,
is it
good
kind
question,
of the
yeah.
normal day yeah. they are coming back yeah. also? And maybe yeah. if I have a museum with entrance fee, would they pay yeah. entrance fee for just a normal visit?
Well, that's a good question. In this country, I don't think they would.
Okay.
I don't, because in England, you have to say, in England, most museums are free.
Okay.
So the norm is not to pay here. Now, in Estonia, the percentage of people who go to museums is much higher. You have a far profounder relationship with culture than we do on a per capita basis. So I think I can only speak for the English example, where no, I think it's unlikely they would pay. But they will, but that doesn't matter. For us, it's not the paying thing. For us, it's are you coming back to the museum? Tate is all free, apart from for the major exhibitions. You don't pay for that. Apart from the big exhibitions where you do have to pay. But 80% of it's for free. So whether it's free or pay for isn't the point. Will you come back? And the answer for us has been in many instances they do come back.
But let's say the same people, you were targeting maybe 16 to 24. Mm. Let's say in 10 years' time or 6 years' time, they are grown up, they are parents with their own kids. Yeah. Would they come back with the kids, or would they still wait for that kind of a disco or a rock star night to happen in the museum in order to show and share?
No, I think they do come back. The experience that we have is they do come back. Listen, I think visiting arts is like a muscle, okay? The more you use that muscle, the more you want it. The less you use it, it just goes away and you forget about it. So I think it's just, you need to exercise the art muscle. and however you get into it, you just get into it. And if it's by having a club night, it's not a club as in, crazy club, but it's a club where there's sympathetic music, there's cocktails, there's poetry readings, there's maybe a bit of theatre, there's a bit of, of culture going on. It works very well. It puts art in a very sympathetic place where people can relate to it in a way. Does everyone come back? Almost certainly not. For some people, they just come for the experience of that one night. But our sense is the return rate is high.
Very good. Can you tell me more about the corporate project you told? That it's important to have the corporate projects. How did you tie them, or how did you conduct them in order to bring in new types of customers?
Well, it starts off from the point of view of fundraising, because we attract corporates to help us put exhibitions on and to help the funding of the museum. Many of those corporates are big companies who are looking to develop corporate social responsibility programs. And part of it is their staff have benefits in the museum. And some of these companies are very big. So for 11 years, Tate had a relationship with Unilever. It now has a relationship with Ernst & Young, EY. Now, that is they are global organizations. And all their staff have benefits when they come to Tate. And that adds to the increasing number of people going. Plus, it's also raising funds so you can do other things, which you can then spend on more marketing to attract new audiences in.
Can you tell me what type of benefits did you offer? If you say that the museum, the entrance is almost for free, what else did you offer them?
Well, it is entrance for free for the collection, but not for the exhibitions. So there's a layer, there are always two exhibitions on it every time. So, for example, there's been just now an Alexander Calder exhibition, which has just finished, staff members of the corporate would not have to pay to pay to get into that exhibition. And that exhibition's expensive. It's £15. It's 20 euros.
Okay, so this was what they had. Had there any other benefits?
Yes, you get discounts in the shop, you get discounts in the restaurant, discounts in the cafe.
Was it well used?
Yes, very well used. Very well used. And Unilever would always report that actually it was always when customers fed back about, their overall package of benefits, they generally felt the thing about the relationship with Tate, whether they went or not, was a really good thing.
Can we talk more about the social media and how to use it? What I face usually here in Estonia, that usually people say that we have a Facebook fan page, we have 200 fans, and we post almost every month something. Yeah. Is
every
this
month?
Enough?
No, you need to post every day. every month, you'll get nowhere. Listen, when I worked at the Guardian newspaper many years ago, the editor of the Guardian was a guy called Adam Ruspiger. This was in the early 2000s. And he made all staff join all social media. He couldn't force you to use it, but he could say, look, you all need to join it. Because basically, you don't really have an opinion on this stuff until you've joined it. And everyone's got an opinion. And the people with the biggest opinions are frequently those who have nothing to do with it and don't even follow it and aren't even on it. And it's very frustrating. So my own view on social media is that it's gone from, oh, it's just for kids where they're just playing, to it's something that's very dangerous because, bad things happen in it. And I think now it's come back to somewhere in the middle, which is basically it's an unbelievably valuable way of reaching an audience, because it's an audience who are asking to follow you. It's not like advertising. They have opted in to follow you, which basically means they want to hear from you. So don't post once a month. Post once a day. The next problem is, well, who should we get to do it? We don't know who to ask to do it. Well, I don't think it should be any one individual. I think it should be passed around the group of the people who work in the museum. I think it's a collective responsibility issue, and I think a wide group of people should be doing it. You should get a different person every week to do it. It's very easy, takes a bit of training. By doing that, you then get the engagement of the museum, and before you know it, you'll have a full set of followers following you. I think if you know, often an exercise I do is, how would you market the museum, or in my case now Christie's, if you didn't have any money? Now, if you didn't have any money and you just had time, social media would be the way that you do it. And you would tell different stories on different social media. So there's an absolute way of doing this.
Give me some examples how to tell different stories in different social media.
There's some very light touch. One of the things that we did on Twitter when I was at Tate was Tate is the home of the National Collection of Contemporary and Modern Art. And 85% of it is locked away because you can't put it all up on the walls. So you change it throughout the year. But lots of stuff doesn't get seen. So we used to do painting of the day. And we would send that out on Twitter with a story attached to the painting. We would do artist birthday of the day. We would send that out. But what increasingly people are doing now, and we use this a lot at Christie's, is you show artworks. And because you allowed both text and image, you can do some really interesting art history and some really interesting text-based activity attached to the visual of the artwork itself. So for me, in certainly in the visual medium that is now Christie's and was Tate, Instagram is heaven. Because it is, because you show beautiful artworks, and underneath it you can have a bit of text about the art, whether it's serious, not so serious, about the artist, about who owned it. And it's all about telling stories. And if you can start a story with a visual image, and then go down and tell a real story beneath it, then it's sort of, you know, that's the perfect solution. So we have, at Christie's, we have Instagram. And Christie's is not like, I mean, it deals in museum artworks, but it's essentially the target audience is high net worth individuals. So it's a much smaller base than would normally go to museums. We have hundreds of thousands of followers on particularly our Instagram feeds, following both individuals in the organization as well as the organization itself. And for us, it's been a fantastic way to reach audiences because they're opting in. So reach them and reach them frequently.
Tell me, is there any logic about how, in which order to tell the stories? Or would it be better that you share the responsibility, different people choose the topics where they feel best, or should it be somehow curated that you tell that, okay, this week we will talk about this, this will go into this campaign? What would be the best solution?
I think you can do both, actually. I think both are relevant. I think it's important to have a framework, but equally I think it's important to allow people to go off piste and have fun. Because I think social media allows you for both. So I would have a framework, but I would also let some random stuff go as well.
I think in Estonia, in museums, I often feel that people are afraid of social media. They are afraid of telling something. It seems that there are so many other more important things to do than to post something in social media. That's why the sequence is once per month, not more often.
My guess is it's probably worse than that. They're probably afraid of audiences rather than just social media, because it does open up a whole... Listen, museums are very conservative institutions. They don't need to be as conservative as they are. They risk nothing by doing this. What they risk is audience engagement, which is actually what they really want. The "we're going to post once a month" is like, you know, it's so old-fashioned, it's frightening. What will happen is someone will do it really well, and then they'll wake up and then they'll all do it. But it takes one to do it. If you can get one to do it, then, you know, you're off and away. But I think the museum director does not have to do it. The museum director has to say to someone else, "You do it, get on with it."
Okay. If I now try to sum up let's say, what are the five most important things to do in order to market a museum today?
I think you absolutely have to know who your audience is. And your audience is not everybody. And very, very rarely is it everybody. So number one, know your audience. Number two is what is the best way to reach them from a media point of view? And by media, I mean anything from social media to paid for advertising. The third one is what's the message you're going to say and what you're actually going to say, because just having a picture and the name of the museum is probably not enough nowadays. You need more of a narrative, more of a story. Why is this relevant to the audience? And you need to explain why that is. And there's many ways you can do that. The fourth one I would do is I would use social media. I would start with social media, and then I would move on to the other stuff, because I think social media is the one that will challenge you the most. And fifthly, I'd be very clear about the narrative of what they can expect when they come to the museum.
If you start from where we began, that a big national museum is going to open in Estonia, and there are smaller museums who are really worried about the traffic. Would you have any concrete solutions for them? What should they do? They have now about 3, let's say 4 months' time to be prepared.
Well, they're worried about getting too much traffic or too little.
Too little. They are afraid of that their customers who used to be there are going to be visitors of the big museum and not going to visit them.
Okay, this is what I really think about that. I think anyone who has a good museum experience will want to do more museum experiences. The experience of the Tate Modern in London, which went, it only opened in 2000 and obviously had no visitors before then, went from no visitors to 6.5 million visitors a year now. That has only increased the uptake of other museums because people are having such a good experience at the biggest museum in London that they want to go to more museums. So I don't believe that it is competitive. It's not like buying Coke versus Pepsi. It's not where you suddenly have one and you would never drink the other. I think if there's a few brilliant museums in one city, it makes people want to go to more museums. So I would not be fearful of that at all. If I was a small museum and there's a big museum opening up, I would up my own game, and I would assume that if the National Museum of Estonia is strong, there's an expectation that people want to come to mine as well. That's been the experience in London.
Very good. I think it's very encouraging. I just do hope that our people are not going to rely too much on the one big museum opening and saying that, okay, now we don't need to do anything because this is going to bring traffic to us as well.
You can ne I don't mean you can never do nothing, but you have to up your game as well. But your expectation, because my expectation is the museum, the opening will be modern, it'll look good, they'll have done it very well. And that will force other museums to do the same.